Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Let's talk about transport. Australia's in the middle of something of an infrastructure boom. In most cities, ambitious mega roads, light rail, rail projects are underway. And they're transforming communities, landscapes and politics too. Mega roads include the WestConnex project in Sydney, in Queensland, the Bruce Highway and the M1 Pacific Highway are being upgraded. In Victoria, the Westgate Tunnel project, the M80 ring upgrade are underway. Federally, of course, the Outback Way is being sealed and widened. These are big projects and are part of a broader political trend in recent years. Governments have taken to making big transport infrastructure announcements in the expectation that it'll not only improve things but win elections and create jobs. But they're often risky and the plans are not often backed by the requisite planning evidence or community support. And there's been a lot of controversy about a number of these projects. Alongside big costs and enormous delays, communities can get savaged too. And thousands of families have had the dreaded knock on the door and learned their homes are to be demolished. In Midwest Victoria, activists have been camping out protecting ancient trees, fearful they'll be lost to a new road. With growing populations and increasing threats from climate change and other issues, we do need proper planning, but we also need proper transport. What's the best path ahead? Are these mega roads the answer? Sydney was touting that it should take people no longer than 30 minutes to get to work. In Melbourne, the figure was 20 minutes. Is that realistic at all in a city the size of Melbourne, which will soon be the biggest city in Australia? Tonight we'll be looking at mega roads, the issues around them, and how they stack up against other forms of transport infrastructure. Joining me is Peter Newman. Peter's Professor of Sustainability at Curtin University in Perth, and he was on the board of Infrastructure Australia. He was awarded the Order of Australia for his work on urban design and sustainable transport in relation to Perth's railway system. Peter, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you, and I'm glad to be on Nightlife.
Terrific to have you with us. Crystal Legacy is a senior lecturer in the urban planning at the University of Melbourne. She's had a long history, a long interest in the politics and community tensions surrounding urban policy and infrastructure, and I'm glad to say she joins us as well. Crystal, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Great to have you with us. And Neil Sipes, a former academic and independent transport and planning consultant, with a current interest in that great bugbear, parking. Neil, good evening to you. I hope you've did you get a park, or perhaps you came some other way?
No, I actually came on the bus. So no problem with finding a park. Anyway, yeah. Good evening, Phil.
Good evening to you. We'll talk about some controversial views about parking, including a view that there is at least adequate parking, and in some cases too much, according to some. Peter, can we start with you? Billions are being spent across the country at the moment on mega roads and rail. You've been in the transport game for many years. Is it all being spent to good purpose?
Well, yes and no. We on Infrastructure Australia certainly. I'm an academic, you know. No,
that's right. You can't occupy both sides of the fence at all times.
No, I don't. And I generally come down to say there's a lot of that is not being spent well. Infrastructure Australia was set up to try and get a bit more of science and economics into the politics of infrastructure, because up until then, there was virtually no rail investment at all by the federal government. It only did roads, and that had really shaped a lot of the cities of Australia.
Why is that? If I open the phones on this, I mean, listeners have been engaged with this issue for a long time. Why is that?
Well, Whitlam did a little bit on rail. He put money into the Brisbane Railway, but that was just a one-off kind of thing. It just was an arrangement with the states very early on that railways would basically be a state responsibility only, and the feds would throw in a bit for roads, and that grew and grew until the majority of public money was going into roads and almost nothing into rail. And that was reversed with Infrastructure Australia, because we found that the benefit cost ratios for rail were very much better than for roads. So a lot of the new rail projects, like the North West Rail and the South West Rail, the light rail in Sydney, all of these were were funded through that Infrastructure Australia process. They had very good benefit cost ratios and clearly were politically pretty good as well. But every now and then you do get the politics coming in, and Tony Abbott certainly tried to get rid of all that federal rail stuff and just do his roads. And one of them, WestConnex, is still going. The other two that he favoured, the Perth Freight Link and the East-West Link in Melbourne, were thrown out politically by the states.
If rail is such a... If rail is on the evidence and on the basis of efficiency and productivity a better option, is it just politics that's prevented it?
Pretty much so. There was a period
That's a depressing conclusion, isn't it?
It is a depressing conclusion, and I was very depressed for some time, but I've been a lot better off since since rail, the second rail revolution, we call it, around the world, because people have discovered rail. The Chinese, for example, extraordinary with their high-speed rail, the metros and so on, that have transformed their cities and transport. In Europe, of course, in Japan, and now even in America, there's a lot of money going into rail projects. In the year that we had Donald Trump win, Los Angeles voted in a $20 billion rail project. So, you know, there's a lot happening in rail, and it's working really well in cities because rail goes around the traffic, and it can be a lot quicker and much more convenient when it's a good network.
Okay, Crystal, these road projects. I mean, you're in Melbourne. Gee, there've been some real stinkers in terms of controversy there, haven't there?
There certainly has been. Yes.
The one to the north of the city. I'm trying to think that remember the name of it now.
North East Link.
The North East Link. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Which had whole suburbs united, and you know, there was a people who would not be activists became activists in relation to this project, didn't they?
Oh, look, I think you might be referencing the East-West Link, which is just in the northern suburbs, but not to be confused with all the other roads that are currently being built in Melbourne at the moment,
exactly.
Upon which there are three. So the East-West Link was incredibly controversial. I mean, that was a project that has been bopped on its head a number of times, and the most recent iteration was cancelled in 2014 following the election of Labor, only to see Daniel Andrews announce not to long after finalising the cancellation of that project with the Westgate Tunnel project, which is another big bad road occupying an inner city part of our community. So, yes, very controversial.
Well, why you use the word big bad road?
I do. Provocatively,
of course. We live in big cities. Doesn't it go with the territory that we are going to have some big bad roads in big cities?
Well, I guess for me, the thing that we need to think about is where we're putting those roads and where we're putting those roads in relationship to public transport and to an active transport network, so cycling and pedestrian spaces. And your listeners who may not be aware that in Victoria, we actually don't have a transport plan. So when we talk about investing billions of dollars into roads without having a plan in place that can offer a narrative to contextualize and to state very clearly what the aspiration is for the city, you can't help but think and be very cynical about what these roads are actually meant to be doing and who and what are they actually seeking to benefit.
That seems to be part of the problem, doesn't it? I mean, it's manifestly a problem, isn't it, Peter, in relation to WestConnex in Sydney, that the project is not well understood and its benefits are not well understood either, and that people find it very hard to see and understand and therefore be taken along with projects which they are not entirely clear what they're for anyway.
Well, nobody understood it because it was designed by Tony Abbott. You don't really get very good results when prime ministers design roads. It's not his business. It didn't come from anywhere else. And that was the same with the Perth Freight Link and the East-West Link. My daughter lives in Sydney and the WestConnex goes directly under her house. But that area around some of the beautiful inner suburbs, Haberfield and so on, completely destroyed. Now, there's no concept at all when we first heard about Westconnex that it was going to be doing that. It's just been ad hoc planning to make it work, and local governments have been totally left out of it, really, because most of them don't particularly want it. And it is meant to try and solve a problem in Sydney with its growth and the growth in traffic. But you're never actually really going to solve it that way. It'll fill very quickly, and that's the problem.
Neil, just bringing you in on the conversation here, can governments build their way out of congestion?
Oh, I think the answer is no. It's basically a short-term solution that politicians like to take because it looks like they're doing something when the reality is that, you know, they can spend billions of dollars and it's not that long before the problem is back to the way it was before they spent the billions of dollars. So trying to get policymakers and folks to realize that you cannot build your way out of congestion, particularly with roads, is a tough nut to crack.
Mm. Tell us about some of the issues that happened in they were kind of mega road disasters, weren't they, in Brisbane in particular?
Well, we had two spectacular ones. I guess the first one was about 10 years ago. The other one followed on 2 years later. But we had two tunnel projects that both went bankrupt within a year of when they opened because they failed to meet their traffic projections. And the reason they failed to meet the traffic projections is they decided to build the tunnels before they realized before they calculated the, you know, how much traffic was really going to use the tunnels. So that's kind of a backwards way of doing traffic planning, and those both failed.
Hmm. As cities grow, people need to get to jobs, don't they? I mean, and there are issues about the amount of time that people will spend on the road, as it were, in the commute. I was interested in a thing, I think it's called the Marchetti Constant, isn't it? Which is a theory about how long people will actually travel to and from work. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, it's, and Peter talks a lot about this as well. Marchetti was a researcher. He was not a planner or transport person in Austria, I think, and he was curious about how much time people spent doing their daily activities, getting to and from work and school. And he basically kind of came up with this 45 minutes each way that people will spend getting to and from work. And it's something that seemed like it exists today and it existed 1,000 years ago. It's, you know,
plenty of people
really
spend
changed.
Longer than that in the big urban conurbations of Sydney and Melbourne, don't they?
Well, yes. I think there's a lot of stories about how much time people really spend. If you look at places like the U.S. that have regular transit surveys that they do, they find that pretty much that 45-minute thing kind of holds. Once people have to spend more time commuting, then they start to seriously think about, you know, either the mode they're taking, can they take a faster mode, can they change where they work or go to school, or can they change where they live? Now, that's the theory behind the concept. And like I said, in the U.S., at least the evidence is there to show that, you know, over the last 30 to 40 years, that's been pretty, even with the growth and sprawl, that's a lot worse in the U.S. than it is here in Australia, that people are adhering to kind of that constant.
Mm. Yeah, okay. Tell me about parking. Because one of the things about roads, if you build roads, you've got to build parking, don't you? Because the roads are full of cars, and cars have to stop at the end, and they've got to be left somewhere.
Well, at least in Brisbane, for instance, the amount of parking that's in the CBD has been declining over the past 20 years because there were surface car parks. Those have been replaced with people moving back to the city, apartments, offices, and so forth. So there's a whole lot less parking. So basically that means the cost of parking is very expensive. And so people that might like to drive to the city have no place to park, so they end up taking public transport. And it's been a very effective management strategy because Brisbane City Council kind of runs the bus system. And they also control how much parking is in the CBD. So that kind of works to their benefit. And you know, I would suggest that if you look at congestion and movement of people going into the CBD, it's not really that bad and hasn't changed that much over the years, mainly because the people can't afford to park once they get there.
Mm. Crystal, with cities, is it possible in the end, if people want to travel distances across cities, is it possible in the end to actually provide transport for them, or do we need to think differently about the cities themselves?
Well, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, when I think about congestion, I often react by saying that it's not just a transport problem congestion. It's a sort of a whole of city planning problem. And so we need to think about it in that integrated way in terms of absolutely everyone deserves the ability to have access to the jobs and services that they need to conduct their lives. And that's not equally capable or possible, excuse me, for everyone across a metropolitan region like Melbourne, which is very low density. And a lot of the concentrated employment is in the CBD. So we need to think about the transport options we provide so that we can move big parts of our community away from car dependency and to give them greater choice. I mean, planning is a living in a city, it needs to be a democratic place. So you need to be able to have choice and be able to exercise that choice. And that includes how you choose to move about that city. And if your only choice is a car, that's not a very democratic place to be living.
Why is that?
Well,
don't cars give you the ultimate mobility, provided there are roads to drive on?
It kind of locks you into a particular form of mobility, doesn't it? So, I mean, what would be a really good option for me and for everyone, I would hope, is one where you choose to get into your car or not, you choose to walk to the shops or not, or you choose to take public transport or not. Mm-hmm. And that creates a more democratic sort of way of and a more participatory city in its fullest sense.
Yeah, back to you, Peter, on this. We talk about cultures all the time. There's a culture of the car in Australia, hasn't there? I mean, for very good reason, in regional Australia in particular, that they're obviously necessary. You wouldn't be able to get anywhere without them. In cities, maybe there's an argument for less of them. I mean, how abiding is the car culture in Australia, do you think?
Well, it's pretty big. There's no doubt about that. It's certainly a major part of who we are. But as Crystal says, we hate being in the car when we're stuck in traffic and we haven't any other options. So when you can get in a train that goes around that, all of a sudden the culture of driving in the car looks a little less attractive. And you jump out and get in the train and, oh, my God, this is good. You're getting there quicker. You're not having to do the driving and it's easy to read something. All of that comes into it. And then you've got the whole bike culture and walking that is so important for our health. Once you find that you can get to certain places within that travel time budget, the Marchetti thing, then you've got real choice. So I've seen the culture change a lot away from the car, particularly amongst younger people in Australia. I really thought I was on my own to start with because I came back from Europe after living without a car and found that it was, you know, almost impossible to get anything done because it was such a total commitment to nothing but roads and cars.
Well, that is true. There is a bit of a cultural shift going on, particularly with young people, isn't there? That young people aren't as keen to get a driving license as they used to be, for example. I mean, possibly for you and me, Peter and Neil and Crystal, you know, it was an abiding obsession to get a driving license as soon as you could.
Well, that certainly was with me.
I don't think so with me either. I mean, I failed to get one, but that was not because of wanting. But that seems to. Do we think that's shifting? Do you think that's shifting?
Oh yeah, no question. And we've all got anecdotal stories about that. But I have a daughter who's in her 40s and still doesn't have a license. Never has had one. It's possible to live that way in an Australian city. You got to live fairly centrally, and you've got to work out how to use your mobile phone to get all the other options together. And when you do, it's actually pretty good. Even in a city like Perth, you can survive like that. And in Europe, it's easy. In most Asian cities, it's pretty easy. But in American and Australian cities, particularly the outer suburbs, it's not easy. And you just stuck in the car. But
I know. Yeah, I get sort of annoyed at I get the constant references to European models, which just really don't have any relevance in Australia, do they? I mean, European models, their cities are different, they're smaller, they're more compact and so on. I mean, cities in Australia are different and require different solutions, don't they?
Well, somehow we're between the American model and the European one, and we're never quite sure which one we are. And the reality is we've always had about a 20% factor. The inner and central areas of our cities are very European, and they are much more European than the American cities, apart from New York and that sort of thing. But the reality is we are caught between the two models, and we toyed with the American one. We've basically given up on that now, and the Americans have too, apart from the politics of getting the odd major road that comes in. It's essentially a lobby process behind it. But I don't think it's the culture anymore. The culture really wants good rail projects, and they are demanding it. We had an 18% swing to Labor in the last election because they had a Metronet project instead of Tony Abbott's Row 8, and it was a major victory. Now, that's not a culture of being totally car-oriented.
Peter, what's cheaper to build, a freeway or a railway?
Well, the railway has the ability to carry 8 lanes of traffic. So if you're going to compare road and rail, you have to say, well, 8 lanes compared to 1 lane of, and it's the space that you usually don't get that can enable that comparison. But the costs of rail have been coming down, so they are reasonable now, and the Infrastructure Australia projects were all assessed on benefit-cost ratios, and they all came out 6 or 7 because the benefits over costs, and the road projects were often less than 1. There was no doubt that there was good economics behind it, and mainly you got other things. You got agglomeration economies, they're called, where you gather concentrations around the railways that roads tend to scatter, and that has a big economic advantage. In the UK now, there's a very big factor in active transport for health gains, and that dominates now their benefit cost ratio. So they're not building hardly any roads in transport for London systems and so on now. So, yeah, it's an interesting process, but usually the politics is very dominant and the benefit cost ratios sit on the side staring at you, and they don't usually say roads first.
What do you make of the argument that the trouble is if you try and public transport your way out of the problem, you'll just get the same congestion that you do on roads? In other words, if you put a railway line in, and you've seen this in London, I mean, a lot of railway lines, in underground lines in London, are completely choked with people. Yeah, which makes for a deeply unpleasant travelling experience.
Yeah, sure, it can.
In other words, if you build a rail, if you build a line, people will come, and that's part of the problem, isn't it?
Well, it is, but if you had that same number of people on roads, you'd have 30 lanes of traffic to take that one subway line. The new systems of trackless trams that I've been pushing are able to take double the public transport along a main road that a bus would take, and that's now looking very cost-effective. It's about a tenth of the cost of light rail, and yet it does the equivalent of that. These are very smart systems that are sensor-guided, and they're electric and very smooth, they will get people out of cars in ways that we've not really imagined before. So I think there are ways coming that are going to make it public transport much more of a network, much more able to compete with cars. And you'll have the heavy rail systems and you'll have the bike systems and pedestrians, but you'll have these main roads having more and more of these really efficient trackless trams.
Yeah, all right. Neil, just back to you too. I mean, trends in transport circles, rails one. What other trends do you see? I mean, we're not likely to see the car off very soon, are we? Despite what people think about self-driving cars and so on. Cars are going to be with us for a very long time, aren't they?
Oh, and in one form or another. And I think I don't think technology is going to be our answer to the transport problem. I think we have to think a bit smarter about how we do things. And certainly one of those ideas that's out there rumbling around is this mobility as a service, which is trying to kind of have a platform that you can subscribe to an app on your phone, and it basically provides you access to a range of different transport modes to take you different places and do different things. And I guess the goal of that is to make better use of the existing infrastructure that we have, because we can't, you know, whether we're talking roads or whether we're talking public transport, you know, there's a limit to how much money we have and how much infrastructure we can provide. And so the idea behind this, the theory, is that let's try to make better use of what we already have by trying to have a platform that where the taxis, the e-scooters, the bikes, the taxis, the public transport, the buses, trains, taxis, cars can all work together to get people from one place to another.
Have we missed the boat, Crystal, because of the lack of investment in rail infrastructure in the past? Have we missed the boat on this? Do you think?
Well, I think if we frame it in that way, where's the hope? I think we have to be optimistic about and very creative as well, and think about these trends not as technological solutions, but as new pathways and practices towards achieving the aims that we set out for our cities. And one of those trends is sharing, you know, shared transport, shared economies. And that's really interesting. I know with my students, they seem to be all really into Uber Pool in a way that it can raise some alarm bells for someone like myself who does quite a lot of work and advocacy around public transport to think through, well, what role is public transport going to play in the future when these new mobility as a service platforms, as Neil's describing, offer this promise of shared mobility, which also includes, embodies this promise of less ownership of the car and a new way of kind of sharing space and sharing mobility practices. It's very, very interesting. But when you think about this word sharing, though, it's very evocative. You know, you want your kids to share, right? You know, these are things that we it's a virtue that we inscribe in our community. But who is actually directing this vision around sharing is often really clever folks in the private sector. So it raises some really interesting questions in terms of governance, in terms of privacy and of data, of our mobility practices. And this is really, really alarming stuff. And it raises some really important critical questions for not only for us academics, but also for government and for civil society at large. And so these are some of the questions I hope we start talking more and more about in terms of when we talk about sharing, what exactly are we sharing?
Yeah, could we talk about, and maybe back to you, Neil, on this too, about the involvement of the private sector in transport projects? I mean, generally, the private sector's been keen, haven't they? But there's a large amount of money washing around the world in the form of pension funds, for example, and other investment vehicles who are looking for stable, long-term investments, pension funds in particular. They're quite attracted to transport projects because they think, well, they're not going to be subject to too many ups and downs. There'll be a reliable form of return, and therefore there's pressure to build them in part for that reason, isn't there? Is that fair?
Well, I think the one thing to understand is kind of the dynamics of who's in the driver's seat. And as Crystal said, it bears some examination. Right now, I'd say Google and Alphabet, their parent company, is kind of in the driver's seat because they basically have the maps and they have the navigational stuff. Mm-hmm. They're also a large initial funder of Uber. Uber's a big funder of Lime scooters. So you have to, if you plot out who's investing in who, it's clear that Google and Uber, the CEO of Uber, said they want to become the Amazon of transport. So, and Google has been, they've been working towards this mobility as a service. They now have a couple projects that incorporate, you know, private providers, but also public transport agencies where they're kind of running the show. So the private sector is really attracted to this mobility as a service idea. I mean, because it's estimated that if you could take a few cents on every trip that's made around the world, you're talking trillions of dollars.
Yeah, well, of course they'd like some crumbs, exactly. I mean, they're maybe not so keen on building the roads on which these activities might occur.
Well, because they don't have to do any of that.
Well,
they think that it's all about, you know, basically providing the platform. Right. You know, they're not going to own any cars. They're not going to own any roads, any rail lines, any of that kind of stuff. They're just going to kind of try to bundle this together in a platform. And and they are using, you know, Amazon as an example of how that's happened. The CEO of Uber came from Expedia, and Expedia was pretty good about bundling those hotels and rental cars and flights together. So that's kind of where the push is. Now, whether they're successful is another matter altogether, because I don't think this is something that, you know, you might have a model that works, say, for Boston, but that model is not going to work for Sydney. It might not work for Brisbane. I think that's where I think this mobility as a service has some problems, because you can't use one model and just replicate it in every city in the world.
John's been here. He wants to ask about a form of transport. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi, Philip, and to your guest. Great topic tonight. I guess I've got three very simple questions, which probably don't have a simple answer.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, nowhere in the conversation do we hear any mention about monorail, and I just wondered why they're not considered more. I know in Sydney we had a bit of a negative experience with the Darling Harbour monorail, but I'm talking a larger scale operation and why that wouldn't be considered.
Mm. Go on.
Sorry.
Yeah,
oh, well, I guess, you know, there's also, I guess, been spoken about for many, many years, but nobody seems to get really fair dinkum about about decentralisation. And to my way of thinking, you know, move a lot of that stuff that doesn't need to be in the big cities out of the city and get the traffic going the other way. I guess the other question is, every road project that they seem to build these days is built for the current time. There's no vision for the future.
That's right. As soon as it gets built, it's full.
Well, yeah, and then they spend, you know, 10 years widening it, and I don't understand. You know, if they'd adopted that attitude with the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
That's right. You know. I think that's exactly right. I think a lot of people would agree with you resoundingly about that. Let's put those questions back to our experts. Peter, monorails were once popular and now seem totally on the nose everywhere. Why is that?
Well, I think the monorail's never really been able to perform as it was promising to do. So a lot of people used the Disneyland one and said, oh, this is the future, but it wasn't much good, and certainly it doesn't go anywhere fast enough. That's always the problem with transport, and it was a technology that was never able to compete with the steel wheels on steel tracks type light rail, heavy rail.
Did it ever have a real? We never had a real crack with it, though, did we? Did anywhere in the world have a real crack with it? Because we built a kind of toy one in Sydney, which didn't go anywhere.
No, the toy didn't work, light rail.
But then again, if you'd had a more comprehensive network of monorail, might it have been effective?
Well, there are various proposals around using these little pod train things like they have at airports. You know, that's a kind of monorail. Look, the Japanese have now got a monorail which is much more effective. It is going faster, and they're, in many ways, the new ability to ride on an air above a magnet, you know, those very fast trains that are being trialled, that's like a monorail, but it's just not performed in any way comparative in terms of the comfort. For a start, it rattles along, shakes you around, and the good thing about a train is it's very steady. So it's just never performed, and I don't think it's likely to compete.
Okay, as a piece of technology, Crystal, maybe to you on that second leg of the question. You know, we talk about this endlessly in Australia, don't we? Decentralisation, and you know, and it's an offshoot, I suppose, of the powerful argument that we should be putting people closer to work and schools and all of that sort of stuff. Now, that's what decentralisation might do, because we'd create smaller places where people wouldn't have to travel so much.
Yeah, I really like the third question as well, the vision for the future. But I'll answer the decentralization one. I was on a panel responding to this question last year around decentralization, and the model I seem to be looking to at the moment is, I'm Canadian. I grew up in a city just outside of Toronto, and Toronto is a very large metropolitan region and has done decentralization in some respects. And part of that has been driven by a land use plan that was very committed to a growth boundary, and didn't move on that, not in the way that we have here in Melbourne. And so that facilitated a level of decentralization in terms of concentrating development across that region. But what's happening now is, as they decentralize, they're now building light rail projects. They are building light rail in the city of Toronto, but also light rail in a place like Mississauga and Hamilton. So to bring that to an Australian context, that would be the equivalent of building light rail in Geelong or building light rail in Bendigo to facilitate the kind of sort of economic development that light rail can often instrumentalize. So when we think about decentralization, we're not just moving jobs and services. We actually need to think about it in the context of how do we plan for movement. And that movement is not just between the capital city and the regional center. It's how are we going to move people in these regional centers as well, which is just a big part of the conversation we need to be having in the context of, and this is me responding to the third question very quickly, the vision for the future. And I just want to say very quickly here, what is the object of focus when we talk about the vision for the future? And I am very concerned about the rhetoric and the conversation being had, certainly in Victoria, around Uber Air, for instance, as being this revolutionary kind of way of thinking about movement. And given the context of what we're going through here in Australia, I can't help but think that the object of our conversation about the future needs to be climate change. Absolutely needs to be climate change, and making that connection to transport. So when we talk about the vision of transport, we talk about how do we do it in a way that mitigates and adapts to this very changing world we're finding ourselves in, and we're obviously seeing firsthand here in Australia.
Mm. Okay, all right. Let's take some more calls. Bill, hello.
G'day.
Hi.
Yeah, the real problem with roads is they're just too inefficient. I mean, look, they added an extra lane onto the City West Link near where I live, and beginning of the year, and halfway through last year, and it's basically just vanished as soon as they opened it. The traffic just filled it.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing about rail is that it's 12 times as efficient in terms of space utilization as road. You can put 12 times as many people. Mm. 24,000 people an hour. You run from the current system between Chatswood and Central. They're running a train every 3 minutes, 1,200 people per train. And compared to a road, you get sort of 1,800 or 1,900 cars an hour, 1.1 people per car in peak hour. Mm. That's only 2,000 people an hour per lane.
Mm. Yeah, I guess, thank you. And I guess, Peter Newman, you'd agree with that powerfully.
Yes,
but,
indeed.
But do we have the economic capacity to actually, given how far we've missed the boat on this, though? We've just had the episode of building the light rail in Sydney, for example, which was massively over budget, cost billions. How many of these can the country afford?
Not many of those, that's for sure. But you were digging up 200 years of history in the process, and that's where all the cost was. But the trackless tram, I think, is going to be significantly cheaper. It's about a tenth of the cost of that light rail.
Tell us about the trackless tram again.
Well, it can carry similar kind of numbers.
Isn't it a bus?
Well, it's if you look at it, it looks like a light rail. Mm. It is running on rubber wheels, but that's about the only thing that makes it a bus-like. It's got electric batteries on the roof, and it is guided so that it actually is very steady on the road. It will take in the bumps on the road as it's coming up and adjust its bogies to run very smoothly and fast. So it will take 300 or 400 people quite fast down a main road. So you can take one lane out of a main road and be carrying the equivalent of 6 lanes. So it is much more efficient and very cheap. So I think that's the kind of thing we're going to move into. And we'll also be getting high-speed rail, I think, out to regional areas that will help.
Really? Isn't this a pipe dream, high-speed rail? Really?
Well, we're the last place in the world to get it. Why is that?
Well, I know, but you know, I've been broadcasting for nearly, 30 years, and every one of those years I've spent some time discussing it, and nothing's ever happened, and there are no projects being planned.
Oh, well, there is one. It's sitting there, and it was almost going to be announced, I thought, coming up to the elections. But there is one of the proposals is a private one because it develops new town centres along the way and pays for it that way, a value capture approach. Mm-hmm. And that's not expensive to government. So if you want decentralisation to happen, high-speed rail will help on that whole process because you then are 2 hours away from cities if you need it for all their health benefits and education and so on. But you can have that life in the country as well.
I mean, you look at it right now and you think, well, look, a Melbourne-Geelong high-speed rail would seem to make sense. A Sydney-Newcastle one would make sense. Certainly a high-speed rail corridor in southeast Queensland would make sense. In a Sydney-Canberra link would obviously make sense, but not only is nobody doing anything about them, nothing's on the drawing board. Well, apart from Sydney-Geelong one, perhaps. There's the Melbourne-Geelong one.
There's a process that's sitting waiting for the bushfires to stop. Mm. it was a well-developed process, and there are lots of bids in, and they're all being evaluated, and they're all waiting for people to get back to government again. Because it's all been dominated, as it should have been, by bushfires.
Mm. Abe, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
That was my question about the fast trains, Indonesia getting into one. They're building one from Jakarta to Bandung and going to be operational very soon.
Yeah.
And Malaysia is going to build one that links China to Singapore.
Yep.
And for the life of me, why Australia is not building fast train, for heaven's sake?
Yeah.
When the Labor government was in power, Anthony Albanese was talking about it when he was the Minister of Infrastructure.
Yeah.
And nothing happened.
Yeah.
They're going to build one from Brisbane to Melbourne. And
yep.
I remember the argument about that. And this continent, we suffer from the tyranny of distance.
Mm.
And let's have a fast train for,
I agree.
About 380 kilometres an hour.
Yeah.
That would be very good.
Abe, I agree. But, to all of you on the panel, we don't see these projects getting up around the world, do we? I mean, in the UK, HS2, the high-speed rail to the north, that's probably never going to be built. The cost of these things now seems so prohibitive that are we having to really to think, are these technologies, in other words, of a previous era when they're just too expensive to build right now?
Yeah, well, I think there are ways of doing it, and the value capture way that has been suggested in Australia is to create a new Geelong or a new Newcastle along the way, and to do that to help pay for that infrastructure, and then you get your decentralisation as well. And I think that's entirely feasible if we think differently and if we have different processes to enable it. It is a way ahead. And that is what they're now looking at in the UK in terms of their rail projects, the Crossrail projects, getting a lot of that value capture to help pay for it. They've got infrastructure project financing authorities which enable these partnerships to help pay for things like that. And I think that's the next phase. We actually have to have private partnerships, not of the kind that Neil was mentioning before, where they dominate and take over everything as a private exercise, but a public-private partnership that enables a lot of the finance to be found through land development opportunities.
Mm. Lydia, hello.
Oh, hello, yes.
Yes, hi.
I'm living in the Northern Rivers of New South Wales, mm-hmm. and we have a crazy situation where we have quite a railway line that's in quite good condition, and the government seems hell-bent on just pulling up the tracks and having a bike path instead. And we're one of the fastest growing regions in Australia, and we also have the second most visited place in New South Wales and the third most visited in Australia in Byron Bay, where we get 2.5 million people a year, and we don't have any real public transport. We've got a railway line which is, we've had various studies done in recent times, and the engineers have been really surprised to see what good condition it's in, even though it hasn't been used for 15 years. But I'm part of a couple of local volunteer groups who are really determined to save our tracks in the hope that we can have a wonderful rail service again to service this whole region, because we need it so desperately.
Yeah, well, hear, hear to that. I mean, and we did a story recently on the Adelaide to Melbourne rail link, for example, passenger rail, which is in dire trouble as well. Are we in danger, Neil, Crystal, Peter, of losing these valuable pieces of infrastructure, that is, rail beds, in the way that we lost tram line easements, for example, in cities before?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And they must be preserved. There hasn't been much interest in those intercity rail projects. The Perth one, you know, it hasn't been upgraded for 20, 30 years. And, there are major connections that need to be expanded. That growth of that part of the transport system through the rural areas, but linking up the cities, that needs to get onto the major Infrastructure Australia agenda and get the states working together to make these work again. We can't possibly go the way of the American cities, which have let them run right down and are now desperately trying to pick it up again at great cost.
Well, actually, speaking of high-speed rail links, the San Francisco-Los Angeles one's in the dustbin too, isn't it? Despite the fact that in California, they actually built a little bit of it just to show that it could be done, but it's never going to see the light of day, I don't think. Duncan, hello. Let's go to Melbourne. Hi, Duncan.
Hi, how are you? I'm just concerned, they're not building for the future, you know. You've got the Craigieburn Bypass in the northern suburbs of Melbourne that runs onto the ring road, and they built it exactly two lanes wide, but they had a complete blank page to start with and plenty of land. And you can understand two lanes wide with budget and everything, but they built all the overpasses exactly two lanes wide. And, you know, you could have made them four lanes wide so you could add extra lanes and everything. And within a couple of years, the road was just running at capacity, and we did on and after 6 in the morning, to go to work, you know?
Yeah. This is one of the issues with road transport generally, isn't it? That you can add to rail capacity, can't you? But adding to road capacity is not easy.
I think one of the really interesting things about Duncan's question is in thinking about the future and building roads, if we're going to build roads in a way that makes them adaptive to different uses. So building roads so that we can change its use into the future to service public transport or even active forms of transport on the sides. I mean, this idea that the future is more lanes of traffic is something I think we need to really question and resist. So when we are thinking creatively about how we solve our transport problems, thinking about what else could that road become into the future has got to be part of the conversation.
What are you thinking here, Chris? You're thinking what? It could become a trackless tram. It could become a light rail, it could become a cycleway, it could become something else.
Absolutely. I mean, one part of the conversation we haven't really touched on is autonomous vehicles, and I'm very critical of autonomous vehicles.
But that's because we on the show here don't think they're ever going to happen, but anyway.
and for good reason. But, you know, that if that is the future, however long that might be from now, then thinking about how do we design a road so we can accommodate that particular form of mobility. But because I am questioning that technology, I'd be more inclined inclined to see that road repurposed to service trackless trams or light rail or heavy rail even.
Take the point. Yeah, we take the point. Look how time has gone, has flown, unfortunately. Look, thanks for your time to everyone. Peter Newman from Curtin University, Crystal Legacy, just speaking from University of Melbourne, and Neil Pease as well. Neil, Crystal and Peter, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much too.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.